Steve Lamb, alcoholic.
Steve.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hopefully you had a good sleep, had a nice breakfast. I don't think they had enough bacon out there for us, though. It's a little light. It was only a whole tub full. We're going to do a few sessions this morning, and they're going to be focused on the retreat and the retreat process. And the first session is called Who Can Teach Me? And when we talk about a retreat, I remember vividly the first retreat I went on. When I was 6 months sober, I got invited to go on my first retreat, and I couldn't do it. It wasn't going to happen. And I asked the gentleman who was trying to convince me what a retreat was, and it's very hard to put in words what really happens. In the definition, the retreat is a place of privacy or safety. It's a refuge. It's a period of group withdrawal for prayer, meditation, study, or instruction under a direction. In the 12 and 12 on page 89, it says that many of us like the experience of an occasional retreat from the outside world where we can quiet down for an undisturbed day or so of self-overhaul and meditation. So it's a time of reflection. It's a personal time. This is a time for you, not a time for me. And it gets down to the basic premise, who can teach me? And the reality is nobody can teach you. Nobody. Absolutely nobody. You know, there is only one ultimate authority in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a God or a higher power or whatever this essence or being is that you want to refer to. And the reality is that we are a society of storytellers. That's what we do. We tell our story. And through our story, we get connectedness. We get a sense of being a part of rather than being apart from. And that's a big thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, it's your retreat. I want to emphasize that after lunch, sometime after lunch, we're going to have a question and ask and answer period, and Rick is going to put out a basket. You can ask any question you want to ask. It doesn't matter, you know. And I'll do my best to either answer it or refer it to somebody else in this room who has the experience that can answer it. I also want you guys to think about, for a while, we're going to have a session on forgiveness and amends. And what I'd like to do is that I'd like to get between two and four of you to tell a personal amends story, between 3 to 5 minutes. And the reason for that will become clear once it's done, but it's part of this bonding experience of the retreat. So on a break, if you're interested in doing that, see me. And if you're not interested in doing it and I want you to do it, I'll let you know. So I'll talk to you about it, okay? But the thing that's to me is really important is the vital importance of a personal experience, of a spiritual experience. And Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. You're here to have your experience, not my experience. And my experience is that the steps are a series of spiritual exercises, and they're designed to allow each individual to find, develop, and maintain a conscious contact with a God or higher power, if you prefer, of his or her understanding, based on his or her experience. And that then in turn allows us to live and move and have our being in the world without the use of alcohol or other party favors or chemical enhancers. And that's how we go through life. I want you to consider some quotations here that I'm going to read to you that really relate to, I believe, the purpose of a retreat and being taught. The first is from St. Augustine. It's from the Confessions of St. Augustine. And he says, "Who can teach me save he that enlighteneth my heart and discovereth its dark corners?" And, you know, he was basically Catholic, so he's referring to God. The next quote is from a guy named Ram Dass. And for the youngsters in the room, you don't know who Ram Dass is. For the old people, I see a couple people nodding their heads. This is a guy named Richard Alpert. And he was involved with a whole LSD experiment, was a disciple of Timothy Leary in the 60s, you know, drop out, drop in type thing. And he became supposedly enlightened. He's now living in Hawaii, and he goes by the moniker Ram Dass. And this is from Paths to God. And he says, "You study the scriptures. You study with teachers. You read books. You attend retreats. You collect knowledge. None of that is wisdom, you understand. It's merely the vehicle that's going to help you get there." And one of the things that we do is we spend a lot of time on the big book, and we read the big book. A couple years ago, you had Bob B. here. And one of the things that Bob B. likes to say about the big book is that it's like a menu. And you can read it and you can study it, but if you don't order off the menu from time to time, you're going to starve. Sandy Beach used to talk about it as the treasure map, not the treasure. The treasure being God or essence or being or whatever that higher power is that you define yourself. But the book is a treasure map. It's not the treasure. Ralph Waldo Trine, in his book In Tune with the Infinite, which a lot of that was taken modeled after the last chapter, A Vision for You. It's written before that, but the Vision for You, a lot of that, the very last two pages are modeled a lot after Trine. And he says, the true teacher will never stand as the interpreter of truth for another. The true teacher is the one whose endeavor is to bring the one he teaches to a true knowledge of himself and hence of his own interior powers, that he may become his own interpreter. All others are, generally speaking, those animated by purely personal motives, self-aggrandizement, or personal gain. Moreover, he who would claim to have all truth and the only truth is a bigot, a fool, or a knave. One of my favorite sayings is from Khalil Gibran. It's the prophet. And he says, the teacher who walks in the shadows of the temple among his followers gives not of his wisdom, but rather of his faith and lovingness. If he is indeed wise, he does not bid you to enter the house of his wisdom, but rather leads you to the threshold of your own mind. For the vision of one man lends not its wings to another man. And even as each one of you stands alone in God's knowledge, so must each one of you be alone in his knowledge of God and in the understanding of the earth. And every time I read that, I think of two people specifically. I think of Sandy Beach, and I think of Scott Redmond, because those were spiritual teachers of mine, and that's how they taught me. Not by telling me, but by showing me. And my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is you cannot tell an alcoholic anything. Not a thing. But you can show him everything. Everything that you've learned. The last one is from a guy named Carl Jung, and we'll talk about Carl Jung for a while. If you're familiar with the big book, you'll know that on page 26 and 27, there's a little story about a certain American businessman. That guy is Roland Hazard. We're going to talk in a little bit more detail about him later. But Carl Jung is the person that Roland Hazard went to see because he was suffering from alcoholism and was going to die. And he traveled over to Switzerland and he saw Carl Jung. And Carl Jung he's probably one of the most instrumental aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous, the early founding, together with the Oxford group and certain other things like Sam Shoemaker. But he had a big part in this. And one of the things that he did was he kept a journal, which he called Liber Novus, or the Red Book. And in his journal, which was not published until several decades after his death, he wrote this: believe me, it is no teaching and no instruction that I give you. On what basis should I presume to teach you? I give you the news of the way of this man, but not of your own way. My path is not your path, therefore I cannot teach you. The way is within us, but not in gods, nor in teachings, nor in laws. Within us is the way, the truth, and the life. Woe betide those who live by way of examples. Life is not within them. If you live according to an example, you thus live the life of that example. But who should live your own life if not yourself? So live yourselves. The signposts have fallen. Do not be greedy to gobble up the fruits of foreign fields. Do you not know that you yourselves are the fertile acre which bears everything that avails you? There is only one way, and that is your way. You seek the path. I warn you away from my own. It can also be the wrong way for you. May each go his own way. And when I think of that, I think of page 55 in the big book, which talks about the great reality which is found deep within us. And it is only there that it can be found. And you'll hear people talk about, Chuck used to talk about what you're looking for, you're looking with. And we don't realize that. So one of the things that we're going to do here is we're going to take some time and we're going to meditate. And if you didn't go to Arne's session this morning, I'm really encouraging you to do it tomorrow. It's a really fantastic thing. When you look at the 11th step, meditation is not optional. It's not optional. And I do a lot of retreats, and I go to a lot of retreats, and I've been at retreats and heard people say, "Well, my mind is so busy, and I just don't meditate." And okay, you don't do the steps. Oh yeah, I do the steps. No, you don't do that. You don't do that aspect. I mean, it's okay. They're suggested. You don't have to do it, but don't complain to me that the steps aren't working if you are not doing them. And I'll tell you, we're going to talk about this probably in detail over the weekend, but my experience with 11-step is it is the most complicated yet simple step. And by that I mean that when you look at the fourth and fifth step, there's some specific instructions in the book. And when you read, basically 84, 85 through 88, there's some instructions on the 11th step. But it doesn't tell you what to pray. It doesn't tell you how to pray. It doesn't tell you how to meditate. It doesn't tell you any of that stuff. And I remember I was very frustrated this when I was working, when I was new, and I was talking to Michael. And I said, well, okay, look, I've read about this. Okay, I get quiet. I do all that kind of stuff. Great. But what prayer, do I do the third step prayer, the seventh step? What's the sequence? Do I do the Lord's Prayer? How do I pray and how do I meditate? Eyes open, eyes shut. Do I have a mantra? Do I burn a candle? Do I listen to tapes? What do I do? And by the way, let's just cut to the chase. What do you believe? And he laughed at me. And he said, Lamb, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. You're here to have your experience, not my experience. And my experience with this is the type of thing that it's very individual. Now, some people get a lot out of a group meditation, and there's some energy there. Some people feel that. Some people don't. But it's like God. When I was quibbling and arguing with Michael about God, I remember he asked me, Lamb, do you like music? I said, well, yeah, I like music. He said, what kind of music do you like? I said, well, I like blues and rock. He said, great. Now, if you knew somebody that liked, say, punk or classical, would you try to convince them to listen to blues and rock? I said, no, they like what they like. I wouldn't try to do that. He goes, exactly, that's just like God. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he said, look, all we're talking about is you trying to get in tune with a frequency that will harmonize your life. We don't care what you listen to. We're just suggesting that you listen. It's just like music. Everybody loves some form of music. And it's individual. It's the same way with meditation. One of the things that Arne talked about this morning, if you were there, was he talked about, if you see the thought, just watch it pass. And there's a spiritual teacher, her name is Pema Chodron. She's a Buddhist female monk. They call him bhikkhun. And she, basically, her practice is that you sit there reflectively, and as the thought comes by, you take like a feather and you just brush the thought aside. That works for a lot of people. I'll tell you that when I've done that, I've just brushing thoughts the whole time. There's a lot of feathers, there's a lot of thoughts, it's just going that way. I talked to Sandy Beach about this one time, and Sandy told me that, he said, look, Lamb, you're in the movie of your life. You can't get out of the movie. You think you're the director, but you're not the director. You're not even the star or the lead actor sometimes. You're just a stagehand, but you're in the movie. You can't get out of the movie. You have some choices. You can either look at the movie as a horror movie, or you can look at it as a comedy. It's much more enjoyable if you look at it as a comedy. And he said, when you meditate, sometimes basically you're just going to watch the movie of your life. Your mind is going to project onto the screen these thoughts. You can fight them, you can try and move them away, or you can just say, okay, God, roll film. Because eventually it will fade to black. And when it fades to black and you get to that void, it's hard to explain, but it's nothing and it's everything. And it's a type of expression and feeling and emotion and experience that one can have but one cannot convey and one cannot regenerate. It happens when it happens. There's contemplative prayer. There is prayer that is a centering prayer. There's all kinds of different prayers. One of the things that Arne talked about too was breathing technique. One of the basic forms sometimes of meditation is to watch your breath and to be consciously aware of your breathing in and breathing out, generally breathing in through the nose, breathing out through the mouth. And we're going to have a period here where we're going to meditate because we're going to really try to get centered for the purpose of this retreat so that we're all in the same mode. But when you're going through this process, I want to tell you, don't struggle. Don't struggle. don't fight it. If you feel like you have to get up quietly and move around, do that. It's not a big deal, okay? Just try to be consciously aware of the people around you. Now I'm going to get back to Carl Jung before we go into this meditation. Again, I was talking about pages 26 and 27 of the Big Book, and that talks about a certain American businessman. That's the guy named Roland Hazard. And he carried the message to Abby Thatcher, who in turn carried the message to Bill. And the Big Book tells us that the doctor, this is Carl Jung, said to Roland Hazard, after he had treated Hazard. So he had treated Hazard, and Hazard had started to go back to the United States. It's hard to tell historically what truly happened, but I'm not sure if he made it to Paris or even across the pond. But regardless, he got stinking drunk again. So he went back to Dr. Jung because he thought he had gotten the mental knowledge. You know, he thought he knew the nature of alcoholism, and that should suffice to keep him from drinking. And he went to him, and he was complaining, and the doctor said, Carl Jung said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one in single case recover where that state of mind existed for the extent that it does in you. Our friend, this is Roland Hazard, felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? And the doctor replied, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements. Huge emotional displacements. That is the same as when Dr. Silkworth talks about the psychic change necessary to take us from the gates of hell to being able to live and move and have our being in the world free from alcohol. In the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. In fact, I have been trying to produce some emotional rearrangement within you. Doctors have been trying this for centuries and millennia, but because they're not alcoholic, we don't identify, we don't listen, and we don't recover. With many individuals, the methods which I have employed were successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Now, Roland went on to go have his vital spiritual experience with the Oxford Group, which together with Carl Jung, Sam Shoemaker, and some others were some precursors to what we now know as Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill Wilson corresponded with Dr. Jung several decades after this all occurred, and he received a response from Dr. Jung before he died. This was a response he received in a letter in 1961. And Dr. Jung wrote to Bill, and he said, your letter has been very welcome indeed. I had no news from Roland H. anymore and often wondered what has been his fate. Our conversation, which he has adequately reported to you, had an aspect of which he did not know. So he read pages 26 and 27 in the Big Book, and he said, yeah, that's what happened. The doctor goes on to say, the reason that I could not tell him everything was that those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I had found out that I was misunderstood in every possible way. Thus, I was very careful when I talked to Roland H., but what I really thought about was the result of many experiences with men of his kind. Again, the emphasis on the personal experience. The doctor goes on to say, his craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst for our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. Listen to that one more time. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. What Roland had found and what we had found was God in a bottle. It was a fake synthetic God, but it worked for a long, long time. Dr. Jung goes on to say, how could one formulate such an insight in a language that is not misunderstood in our days? He says, the only right and legitimate way to such an experience, again an experience, is that it happens to you in reality. And it can only happen to you when you walk on a path which leads you to higher understanding. You might be led to that goal by an act of grace, some people are struck sober, or through a personal and honest contact with friends, you're amongst those this weekend, or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines of mere rationalism. If you look at the appendix to spiritual experience, it refers to that. The doctor says, I see from your letter that Roland H. has chosen the second way, the Oxford group, which was, under the circumstances, obviously the best one. He then says, I am strongly convinced that the evil principle prevailing in this world leads the unrecognized spiritual need into perdition if it is not counteracted either by real religious insight or by the protective wall of human community. Alcoholics Anonymous is a protective wall of human community. An ordinary man, not protected by an action from above and isolated in society, cannot resist the power of evil, which is aptly called the devil. But the use of such words arouses so many mistakes that one can only keep aloof from them as much as possible. These are the reasons why I could not give a full and sufficient explanation to Roland H. But I'm risking it with you because I conclude from your very decent and honest letter that you have acquired a point of view about the misleading platitudes one usually hears about alcoholism. I mean, back then, alcoholism was a sin. You know, alcoholism was a criminal act. There were people that were put in insane asylums and institutions and jailed because of alcoholism. He goes on to conclude, he says, you see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus, and you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most depraving poison. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum. Spiritus and spiritum can be alcohol or spirit, God. So God without alcohol or alcohol without God. But if you're alcoholic, not both, one or the other. And if you get to the point where you can no longer consume alcohol, you're going to insist on having that experience. And the only way you're going to find that is by developing an understanding and experience with some type of higher power, whatever you may call him, her, or it. So what Dr. Jung is saying is that we're all seekers. Alcoholics are all seekers. We've been seeking our whole life. And we found it for a while. And then the little bitch turned on us. Okay? And we kept trying to go back to her, but she just wouldn't respond appropriately anymore. So we need to find an alternative. And if we don't find that alternative in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and through the program of the 12 steps, we'll go back to her, even though she's painful and she hurts us, because we're seekers and we can't not seek. And again, this goes back to the great reality that it talks about on page 55. Now what we're going to do is I'm going to ask your indulgence. We're going to have a relatively short 10-minute meditation, any way you want to meditate, eyes open, eyes closed. It generally helps, like Arn said, when you meditate, to try and get situated where you're centered on the chair, your feet are flat, your hands are comfortable, and your shoulders are not necessarily direct, but they're not slouched either. You want to be able to relax. And this is not specifically a guided meditation, but before I start with the meditation period, I'm going to read something. And I'm going to ask you to basically just shut your eyes and think about this. And then after the reading is over, we'll start this 10-minute period. And you can think about or not think about whatever you want to. But this is something that I particularly like because to me, it is one of these universal descriptors of God or a higher power, and it relates, at least in my view, to what we are and why we are here in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is called Thunder. It's from Nag Hammadi, which is Codex 6. And for those of you that aren't familiar with that, you've probably heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These are not from the Dead Sea Scrolls, but these are ancient scrolls that were extracted from an area in the Middle East. So they're certainly not biblical scriptures, but they were written several millennia ago. They were written on a parchment, and some of them, there's only parts of them. They're not complete, because what happened was these ancient desert fathers would be going these hermitages. They would just go out into the middle of the desert and be out there for about centuries until, you know, they passed away and died away. And all this stuff was locked up and it was kept in urns. And over time, different people have excavated these and found these. So this is called Thunder, Nag Hammadi Codex 6. So just shut your eyes and get comfortable and reflect on this. I was sent out from the power and have come to you who study me. and am found by you who seek me. Look at me, you who study me, and you who hear, hear me. You waiting for me, take me into yourselves. Don't banish me from your vision. Don't let hatred enter your voice against me, or let anger enter your hearing. In no place, in no time, be unknowing of me. Be alert. Don't be ignorant of me. I am the first and the last. I am silence incomprehensible in an idea remembered often. I am the voice whose sound is manifold and word whose appearance is multiple. I am the utterance of my name. I am one before whom you are ashamed, and to me you are shameless. I am one who is honored, praised, and scornfully despised. I am peace, and war has come because of me. I am alien and citizen. I am the substance and one without substance. Those unconnected to me are unfamiliar with me, and those in my substance know me. I am within. I am unspeaking mute and enormous in my many words. What you see outside you, see within you. Many pleasures exist in many sins, uncontrolled passions and disgraceful desires, and brief pleasures embraced by people until they sober up and float up to their place of rest. There they will find me and live, and they will not die again. Gentlemen, the seatbelt sign is no longer lit. You are free to move about the cabin. Come back at 10 o'clock. For those of you without watches, that's when Quasimodo rings the bell. And I'd like some amends stories.